Hi, you are listening to the Conflict and Development in Africa podcast. This podcast is for policymakers, governments, researchers, students, businesses, and anyone that is interested in conflict and development issues in Africa. On this podcast, we hear from experts from across Africa and the world. Your host, Dr. Michael Wangpa, will ask the questions you would want answers to. Michael Wangpa has an extensive experience spanning over a decade studying, researching, writing, and consulting on conflict and development issues in Africa.
Hello and welcome to another episode of the Conflict and Development in Africa podcast. I'm your host, Dr. Michael Wangpa. Today we're going to be discussing an important topic, land conflicts in southeastern Zimbabwe. I'm joined by a very special guest and a very good friend of mine, Dr. Eric Kushinga Makombe. Dr. Makombe is a research fellow in the history department at the University of the Free State, South Africa, and is also a senior lecturer in the Department of History, Heritage, and Knowledge Systems at the University of Zimbabwe. Eric has written extensively on land conflict in Zimbabwe. Eric is also one of our fellows, so Eric is a very, very good friend. Eric, it's a pleasure to have you join me today, and I look forward to a very wonderful conversation.
Well, the pleasure is all mine, and I'm grateful to be here. I'm looking forward to our conversation.
Sure. Brilliant. So let's start off. Can you provide a context into this land conflict? Because we really, I know back in the days when we had the former president, Mugabe, you know, we sometimes hear about white and black farmers and land issues, but we're really here in the media about land conflict. So can you provide a bit of historical context and the contemporary context on land conflict in Zimbabwe at the moment?
Well, thank you very much, Michael. Yes, indeed. I think that particular exercise, that is the land reform exercise that occurred at the beginning of the 2000s, where the government led by the former and late president of this country of Zimbabwe, Robert Gabriel Mugabe, repossessed land from a minority white, group of commercial farmers and redistributed to the landless Africans. So that made international headlines because of the nature in which it was done and because of the parties involved that also included our erstwhile, colonizer, that's the United Kingdom, and the resistance that it offered. But the whole context of how that reform exercise was carried out occluded or at least silenced the repossession of land that occurred a few years after that, starting around 2008, that was primarily state-led forms of repossession from black-owned communal land by the state or by the government principally. To allocate it for private use, for privatization, private players, so the state was at the head of this, and so that was a silent repossession that occurred. But it is also within the context of global trends. There was a food and financial crisis around this time, 2007, 2008. That led private capital to enter into several land deals, principally in Africa, but also in Asia and in South America, in which vast amounts of land were privatized or taken over by private capital to grow food, but also to grow products such as oil pounds, that are used in rubber and also ethanol, that sugarcane used for ethanol production. So all of this was occurring at around the same time, but because now the instigator is private capital, globally, you find that this didn't make it to the major headlines. Didn't make the major headlines at this time. And also that the face of the people who are doing the repossession are now changed. You find that there's a lot of Asian capital mm-hmm. that is leading this. For instance, if you look at the situation in Madagascar at around mm-hmm. 2008, there was this caused a major uproar, maybe because of the scale of it, in which Daewoo mm-hmm. Motor Corporation entered into a deal with the Malagasy government mm-hmm. possessed about 1.3 million hectares of land. That is like half of the arable land in Madagascar. So this caused mm-hmm. some uproar, but this was unlike the situation in Zimbabwe, where the land did not amount to such large tracts of land. But this is kind of like the global and the local context in which all of these land repossessions are being done, but they are also occluded from making it into the public in popular media.
Mm. So what we've seen is thank you. That's a very comprehensive context that you provided in there, and we've seen the intersection between the global and the local, how they interact in this. So I like the transition or the trajectory from where. Otherwise, and we've seen it as well in South Africa. Maybe we've seen it with ANC. We've seen with ANC where with the apartheid system and President Mandela coming into power and ANC coming into power on the anti-colonial narrative. We've seen it also with the Frelimo party in Mozambique, where you see these people coming into power, on the anti-colonial narratives. And then gradually what you're seeing now is that transition. We're seeing new actors, like Riley said, talk about the Asian capitalism. This is where capitalism is coming in, like neocolonialism and all that. But in all of this, when they say when two elephants fight, it is the grass that hears it. So the people, how has this affected? I know you mentioned slightly, but can you provide more details how it's affected the actual people? The landowners or the farmers in Zimbabwe.
Well, yes, I agree partly with in full with your assessment that many of the governments here, particularly in Southern Africa, what they tag themselves or they label themselves liberation movements, mm-hmm. so they continue to ride this crest that decolonial movements and so forth, mm. but kind of at the subterranean level, you find that they are in bed with capital, and they are essentially being used as the battering ram to dispossess people of land and their livelihoods. And this is precisely kind of the impact that this has had, principally in the area in which I'm investigating, that's in southeastern Zimbabwe. So the impact is major, it's been severe in terms of their livelihoods. You find that the area itself is largely, there's mixed land use patterns, but you find that the majority of the land users were settled in what we call agroecological regions 4 and 5. So these are semi-arid regions. The little land that was there was used for pastoral livelihoods around cattle, goats, and other smaller livestock. But now, mm-hmm. because of the parceling out of land for privatization and for urbanization mm-hmm. purposes, you find that many of them are having to relocate. First, it was a marginal movement to their kith and kin across in other chiefdoms that had not yet been affected by this. So they would rent out land for, say, $30 and $40 per hectare. But with time, as this dispossession proceeded to where they had relocated, they are forced now the field to areas like Mozambique. So it has been a devastating displacement of not just their livelihoods, but also their way of life. Kids have had to, school children, that is, they've had to, you know, relocate to new areas, maybe live with relatives whilst their parents are now continuing with agricultural livelihoods in neighboring countries, that is principally in Mozambique. So it has been far-reaching. The people have had to resort to alternative livelihoods, some of which entail offering themselves to petty menial tasks in some of the there's no real industry growing, but you find that, for example, there's an ethanol plant, so some offer their services there on a part-time basis, and maybe sweeping government offices, that sort of thing. So menial tasks to replace the livelihoods that have been dislocated, but you also find that there's been a recourse to livelihoods that they never imagined, such as prostitution and other vices, like crime, petty crime, but also others have gone on to cross border trading in South Africa and so forth. So I think it's a topic in and of itself, but the livelihoods have been dislocated, and owing to the displacement of the livelihoods that they have known previously around agricultural production, pastoral farming, and so forth. So I would say that is the context within southeastern
Zimbabwe. I've got to come back to you. Go on. I think you have to go something.
I was saying where perhaps they had previously been able to farm, say, a hectare, they are now having to farm on a smaller piece of land, and this is then exacerbated by droughts and other issues that I'm sure will come to. But that is kind of the overall context.
Exactly. But before we go, there's something you mentioned, and you got me thinking, because in East Africa, so let's say in Uganda, for instance, and I don't know if it's in Congo, I don't know if Abo, I know in northern Uganda, and also in the Sahel, like in Nigeria, for instance, in the northern part of Nigeria and the middle belt, there's the farmer herder conflict where you have between the pastoralist and the farmer. So you mentioned pastoralist and farmer. Is that evident in Zimbabwe? Do you have that kind of contestation between or conflict between the farmers and pastoralists? It's like nomads. Do you have nomads in Zimbabwe?
Not in the sense of like say the Maasai or anything like that, but you find that conflicts have arisen more so in the recent past owing to this dispossession. You find that because the grazing areas have now been cordoned off because of a government gazette, you find that cattle or livestock in general then going on to graze on lands that had been previously used for agricultural purposes. So those conflicts are indeed emerging at this time. Because, before this dispossession, that is the period prior to 2008, these conflicts were minimal because people could, coordinate or work around these two systems, that is agricultural, farming, crop production, and pastoral production. So, but it is now emerging now as a trend out of the dispossession that is occurred post 2008.
Okay, so let's link that dispossession to, you mentioned two key things that have led to that dispossession. One is government policies, deliberate government, you know, policy that, you know, through private capitalizations taking over this land. But you also mentioned climate change. So how much of this dispossession, or I guess the question is, how much, what's the percentage of this dispossession or this disruption, dislocation is being caused by climate change? And how much of it is caused by governance or misgovernance? And how does that relate to the emerging, does that play a role in the emerging conflicts with pastoralism and farmers?
I would say that in the district, particular district that I'm exploring, that is in the Chipinge district, there are about 39 wards. And you find that the land conflicts are occurring at this stage in about 16 of the wards. That's under half or just under half of the wards there. And many of these conflicts are state-driven. They are state-driven, where the government represented in Chipinge by the Chipinge Rural District Council, which is like the local state in that district. So the local state acts at the behest and in behalf of private capital on one hand, but it is also acting on their own behalf. In the sense that our local councils are underfunded, so there is a quest for new investment, where they go on to designate certain shopping centers, like rural shopping centers, and they designate them for urban development, where they want to set up what are known as growth points, or rural service centers and so forth. That is kind of the where these conflicts then emerge. So once these areas are designated, it dislocates the communities, as we have just stated. But climate change then comes in and it exacerbates what is already in motion. So it's kind of adding insult to injury, so to speak. So I think that is kind of the relationship, where people who are already, dispossessed of land, that is at an economic scale, say from a hectare to a fraction of an acre, they are now then have to contend with the vicissitude of climate change. Here, I'm just thinking that in the past year, 2023, we experienced the worst drought in the past 40 something years, I think, since independence, 1980. So, people are having to plant on smaller pieces of land, but the drought comes and it, then burns everything. So you get that kind of relationship where you cannot then exercise varying forms of livelihoods. You have relocated your cattle to another country. You are left with just a small piece of land, and then the drought comes in. So indeed, we are seeing the impact of climate change, in that there's a recurrence of droughts now after every 2 years. The rainy season is gone down by a minimum of 10 days. So these and of course there have also been cyclones, the most devastating of which occurred in 2019, called Cyclone Idai, that ravaged many parts of this district of southeastern Zimbabwe. So because of its proximity to the coast of the Indian Ocean, so you find that indeed climate change is then wreaking havoc upon a people that are already having to contend with displacement and dispossession of their land.
Now, we'll be definitely, I think it also confirms what was been in the literature, the controversies regarding whether climate change is a primary factor in conflicts. And I think it confirms that it might just be an exacerbating factor, and one that requires more conscious and deliberate intervention to prevent the aftermath. But let's go to the international or regional implications of this conflict, and before come back to the local. So we've seen where people have been displaced and people have to move, like Riley said, regionally. Maybe move to like Mozambique. We've seen people move to Zimbabwe. We've also seen people move to Botswana. But in those also contexts where it then creates some sort of tensions between the Zimbabwean populations and the citizens of those host countries, and create those. How does that? And I'm linking that to the recent Botswana president saying like about 95%, if I'm not wrong, of the migrants in Botswana are Zimbabweans, and trying to regularize, and also looking at the skill set that they bring, and those tensions that they. And then we've also seen in Zimbabwe and the treatment of Zimbabweans in South Africa. So what I'm saying is, what are the wide implications, regional implications of this displacement on regional security and regional interactions or relations, intergovernmental relations?
Well, thank you for that. I think I'll take your cue from the way you framed it. It is indeed wider implications, because what is occurring in the dispossession, the dislocation that occurs in southeastern Zimbabwe, you know, reverberates across the region. You find that many young men, primarily in southeastern Zimbabwe, are migrating to Johannesburg. Some even go there before they take, their documents, that is their national ID or passport even, from the capital, Harare. So many know Johannesburg as their capital, rather than the Zimbabwean capital. So there is that impact where, undocumented Zimbabweans feel it's better that they just jump the border and live illegally in South Africa. And we've heard of xenophobic attacks that instills, because these people are undocumented and as such they are open to exploitation. That is an impact in terms of regional and just in terms of the conflict and security levels that inculcates in the region, in the sense that when there's the conflicts that arise around xenophobia and the conflicts that then ensue around this are emanating really from a localized crisis. And as such, the Botswana president is saying, rather than spend resources on driving these people to the border, but they then simply, as soon as you leave them, they walk back, because they know that there is nothing for them in Zimbabwe, back home, really, because the land has been taken, their cattle they've been forced to sell their cattle and so forth. As such, so this is kind of the animosity that it creates amongst the citizenry of these countries. But however, I would say maybe at the leadership level, this is, I'm yet to hear of any, in terms of the communiques that come out of, their regional interactions at SADC and so forth, whether this has been a topical issue. Perhaps now, since we are now seeing, in many countries, these former liberation movements being replaced, like what is occurred in Botswana just now, where the party that had been in power for 58 years was replaced by a new party. This is what has already occurred in Zambia, where the long-serving parties are now being replaced. So perhaps the new politics that these newer parties that are coming in would be able to discuss some of these issues, openly and honestly, such that, these issues are addressed. But in the past, regional bodies like SADC has just been like old pals club, and where they, dance around some of these issues that are supposed to be really topical, but they affect the citizen. You can appreciate, we are not saying xenophobia is good or anything, but you can appreciate how, hordes of people, come and they can accept lower wages, and how that impacts on the livelihoods of the people in the receiving countries. So, you know, I suppose there needs to be some candid talk around some of these issues moving forward.
Speaking of old guards and liberation parties, like Riley mentioned, we've seen it looks like the old guards are being challenged and being replaced. We've seen in, you mentioned Zambia, you mentioned Botswana. We also see Frelimo is barely holding on to power in Mozambique, where we've seen the challenger nearly, you know, and I think it's still ongoing in terms of the challenge to Frelimo's emergence in that election. And also, you know, we see in other places as well. So in Zimbabwe, for instance, with all of these land conflicts and displacements, how is that? Is that raising some kind of like consciousness, political consciousness or activism, where people are beginning to? Because I know the presidency of whatever is somewhat a continuation of Mugabe's, is still like the old guard. So are we seeing some sort of activism or challenge to the old guard? Are we seeing that?
Next one, because you find that let me start off by just, you know, pivoting from my case study. You know, in the 2008s, when this is all occurring, and following the 2013 elections, for example, some of the constituencies in the Chipinge district were under opposition figures. But these are the very people that requested the central government to gazette or to designate communal land as a state land. So in terms of the thinking, the ideology, you find that it is the same between the opposition and the ruling party, that you can do away with communal tenure and communal livelihoods and replace it with you know, centrally planned urban spaces. So there is that, that in terms of ideology, there is really no difference between the opposition and the ruling party, that is the ZANU-PF, that has been in power since independence. But in terms of the local activism, yes, it is something that is impressive and organic and organically generated. You find that there are movements, grassroots movements that have emerged in southeastern Zimbabwe that are led by, you know, graduates that have you know, graduated and they've nowhere to go, so they come back to their home area and decide to, you know, spearhead and lobby against the repossession, dispossession of their parents and so forth. So there is that. But perhaps where these movements come undone is a recourse to the law. You know, it is always a recourse that they, you know, is maybe even their first resort to want to take the government to the courts of law. And the decision is invariably always not in their favor. So once that happens, they're disempowered. You know, you have a court order against you, you have a government gazette, so you are now seen as acting illegally. So that doesn't, you know, help them at all. So perhaps it is something that they need to look at, and maybe look at other ways. You know, if you look at the Madagascar case that I mentioned, the response by the communities that were going to be displaced by this Dewu land deal was immediate. It was political. It was, you know, vociferous. It was just a political action that they took, that, you know, when the next election cycle came, the government was replaced. So that unfortunately has not yet taken place. Whilst indeed there are impressive efforts at you know, grassroots movements against these dispossessions that are occurring, but it has not translated to political action, primarily because maybe in terms of the ideology, informing both the opposition and the ruling party. They are kind of there's a convergence there.
That's quite interesting. That would have been impressive to follow on. Perhaps looking at what is happening in the Sahel, where jihadist movements kind of like capitalize on local grievances and they'd be like conflict merchants and then try to recruit. So it'd be an impressive question to have. Maybe if we have time, I'll come back to see if you've, you know, seen any of that happen, or if you see the possibility of that happening. Whereas as Zimbabweans move to these places like Mozambique, where you have, you know, insurgent groups, whether that could be a case where, you know, these groups can seize on those local grievances and then create some sort of credible threat to the Zimbabwe. But I think the question I want to ask now is, you mentioned Chipinge. So that's Chipinge. I wanted to ask, how much independence does Chipinge Rural Community have from the central government? Because in terms of that land dispossession, so are these central laws, or are these laws that are made at the community level by Chipinge local council? So how much is the separation between the central government in Harare and the Chipinge rural district in terms of dispossession? Whose corridor is this line? Is it the state, is it the central government, or is it Chipinge, or are they in Kahoot?
Well, there's no independence at all. The rural district council is acting on behalf of the national government. So there's really no separation at all, even though it should be there on paper. It simply remains a paper separation. So the local state, that is the Chipinge Rural District Council, is acting on and behalf of the national government. But what we find that is the bureaucracy that mans the Chipinge Rural District Council also have vested interests in you know, in seeing the dispossession of local communities. For example, if we take a community that has been designated like Mahachi, that's a ward in Chipinge, we find that most of the beneficiaries were the bureaucrats that were in charge of the Chipinge Rural District Council. So in terms of the parceling out of stands, they acquired the most stands. So they have a vested interest in seeing that land is designated as urban, so that they can then, you know, acquire more, as much stands as they can, housing stands, and then they can then sell them off to you know, to private buyers. So it's not as if they are simply acting without any you know, out of altruism or sense of duty, but they have a personal stake in seeing that this land is parceled out and they can you know, benefit. So they have a vested interest in seeing that land is designated for urban planning purposes.
There'll be no need to ask what government's effort is then in addressing the conflict, because the government itself is the perpetrator. So it will be like, but I guess the main question to ask is, you've mentioned in the Madagascar case, you've mentioned, you know, Asian entrepreneurs or whatever, but you keep mentioning private entities. And I know in our previous interactions, you've mentioned Greenfield. So I just wanted to touch on the actors. Who are the main actors in this? Who are the main beneficiaries in this land disposition? Who are the actors?
Okay. The government is the perpetrator. But there are also other arms of government, I suppose. We have what are known as Chapter 12 institutions. These are supposed to be independent, you know, institutions that can address societal ills. Yeah, we have, for example, the Zimbabwe Media Commission. So if there are any grievances against the media, this is kind of the body that is supposed to mediate. So in this case, we have had, for example, the National Peace and Reconciliation Commission that had gone into Chipinge to investigate, but nothing came out of it. You know, we've had a parliamentary committee that was during around 2010, 2011, that was headed by a deputy prime minister. This is during the time when Zimbabwe had the government of national unity. But again, nothing really, really came out of it. So that is from parliament. There are all sorts of allegations that were thrown around that some money changed hands and so forth, but I didn't want to substantiate that in the lack of evidence. But you find that even independent institutions that are supposed to then act on these people's behalfs are either captured or too scared to do anything. So there's really no difference there. Then you at the actors around green fuel, I think at the head of it or the person who leads it is a notorious character across the region, that is the Southern African region, known as Billy Rottenberg. You know, if you go to South Africa, he has a bad track record there. He was once indicted for fraud. He went to the DRC. He was then, expelled by the Kabila. So he has, wherever he has gone, he has caused havoc and damage. So he's the same character, but originally he's Rhodesian. That is Zimbabwe's former name before independence. So he was born in the 60s and so forth. So he has it's a notorious and murky character, really. But there are allegations that he's acting on behalf of other remnants of colonial capital. So essentially the farmers that were thrown out, or at least whose land was repossessed in the early 2000s by Robert Mugabe. So they are back now. They are now funding this entity known as Green Fuel and the sister company known as MacDom to essentially repossess what was taken during the land reform exercise. Green Fuel is perhaps a front, really, of various interests based on colonial capital and other investors who are known at this point. But the front of the company is Billy Rottenberg. So besides in Chipinge, they also have land in the neighboring district of Chiredzi, land in other parts of Zimbabwe, Nwanetsi, and so forth. So the company is amassing land. So it's, through... government players. So they are amassing vast amounts of land. When they intend to occupy some close to 50,000 hectares in Spinga district and to put it under sugarcane production. So you'll find that, this is what is occurring. Perhaps what is really occurring would need some form of investigative journalism. But I think this is what is occurring.
Brilliant. Let's come to the last question. So just take a broad look and what do you project? How do you see all of this playing out? Do you see a future where there is a resolution to this lack of fight? If that is the case, how would our image, how would that look like? But if not, if it's going to be even be bleak, how bleak can it get? How worse can it get? What do you see if you just conclude with that?
Well, I think right now when you find that the way this conflict is occurring, it is posing this becomes something of a national security threat in the way that it then, because if we rule out the opposition here has been decimated and so forth, but even within the ruling party you find that the factions, that the warring factions within the ruling party are informed by these interests. So you have contestations around who should lead, whether someone's term should be extended or not, but it's all hovering around the interests that are behind that person. So if they are not handled well, it could actually erupt into civil strife because of these factional contestations that are now occurring. But we find that kind of at a subliminal level, that the interests that are informing these factional contests are really around the role that these erstwhile colonial relics of colonialism are continuing to play, the amount of land that they are earmarking for further dispossession is incredible. It's just staggering when you hear it. So at that level, there is danger of this, really spilling over. But as again, we come back to the question that we talk about the regional dimension, that is more and more people are dispossessed. You find that because regional imbalances and regional conflicts may also arise out of this. But whether this would then translate to some form of local insurgents rising against the state, I would say that's highly unlikely because of the option that Zimbabweans have exercised for such a long time, since around 2000. The economy and it's just been a social and economic dislocation nationally. And the recourse that many Zimbabweans have resorted to has always been to migrate. Those with minimal means have, decided to cross over to our neighboring countries. But those with means, those with say, education and some qualification, are going as far as the UK, where you are. So there is that. You find that we have a large diaspora. Some say up to 5 million people are outside the country. So this may simply be heightened rather than seeing it translate to some form of local insurgency. But it's difficult to predict. But you will find that my concern really is that if these dispossessions are left unchecked at the rate in which they are occurring across the country, then it may go into some form of civil strife emanating from these factional contestations that I was alluding to.
Well, let's stop at that, Eric. But this has been very eye-opening and very refreshing. Not refreshing in a positive way, because it does look like whichever way we look at it, it's not good news. But well, thank you very much, Eric, for honoring. And thank you for the rich insight.
Thank you so much. I enjoyed the talk.
Me too. I'll keep in touch. Yes, definitely. All right, Eric. Okay. Thank you very much. We'll speak soon.
All right. Okay. Bye.
Bye. Thank you once again for tuning in this exciting episode with my very special friend and guest, Dr. Eric Makombe. I hope you've gained immensely, as I've gained as well. And as usual, join me to thank him, and I implore you to join me again next week for another interesting episode. For now, stay blessed, and I'll see you.